If it pleases the court, Marvin Putnam of O'Melveny & Myers on behalf of the appellant, which is Bristol Bay Productions, formerly known as Crusader Entertainment. And at the onset, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for my rebuttal. All right, Your Honor. And as an initial matter, what I would like to address is the question that was posited by the court a little over a week ago. The court specifically asked whether Dave Peterson Electric impacts whether the affirmative defense of issue preclusion can be raised in a motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim. So right at the offset, I'd like to address that. And the answer is it does not. Now, the reason it does not is multi-pronged. But first and foremost, the reason is because this issue was already decided by the Supreme Court. It was decided by the Supreme Court in Ruth. Ruth was very clear and said that the affirmative defense of issue preclusion can occur, one, upon evidence adduced at trial, two, on summary judgment, or three, and this is what's important here, on a 12b-5 motion converted to summary judgment under Rule 56. So this question has already been done by the Supreme Court here in Colorado. How recently? Well, I would argue, Your Honor, that they've reiterated it throughout the entire last, I think it's 36 years. How many? It may have been 40 years. And what I mean by that, Your Honor, is that if you look at the cases, they've done nothing to overturn that. They've done nothing to change that.
How about the last time they made
that precise pronouncement? The one I'm relying on, I would say Bebo is probably the most recent pronouncement where they've done this, but I would also argue, Your Honor, that they've had no case in which they've not done that. And I think that's what's important here. In no case has the Supreme Court here in Colorado overturned its decision in Ruth. In fact, if you look at O'Neill, which is the one that is relied upon by the defendants here, that is not at all what O'Neill does. They say that O'Neill tacitly overturned. Well, O'Neill did not tacitly overturn. In fact, what O'Neill did was that it said nothing about Ruth. It did not mention conversion or the need to convert. And in fact, it declined to reach the issue on 12b-5 grounds. Okay? And that is what is important here, Your Honor, is that there's no case, but no call by the Supreme Court case that has changed Ruth's determination. You can raise this on 12b-5, but if you do so and decide issue preclusion under 12b-5, you must convert it into a summary judgment motion under Rule 56. What?
Said in Bebo.
It was not precisely said in Bebo. What happened to Bebo, Your Honor, was it
Bebo? It wasn't precise.
The last one was precisely said, Your Honor, was in Ruth. That precise pronouncement is in Ruth. Now, Your Honor, the other reason that Peterson Electric does not do this is because what Peterson was doing is he was addressing when you can first raise the issue. Do you have to first raise it in an answer? Or can you, in fact, raise it later on a motion to dismiss? That was the issue that was happening in Peterson Electric. And the court determined that, no, you didn't have to have answered it in a prior pleading. You could raise it later, in that instance, on a motion to dismiss. What it did not address was conversion, because that was not relevant to the issue there. In fact, the entire discussion in Peterson is dicta. And the reason it's dicta is the determination in Peterson was on a very different ground. It looked to a different statute to determine this. And I think that's very important for what you look at when you look at Peterson. In fact, because there is no case that has overturned Ruth, and Ruth has continued to be the law of the state, I think that the court needn't go further in this matter. And the reason the court needn't go further in this matter is Ruth has indicated that if you do not convert, you cannot decide issue preclusion on a motion to dismiss. And here,
what are we to do with those one or two or three cases in the meantime from our divisions of our court that say you can't?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, I would argue, and I think you're looking at Goldsworthy and Negron would be the cases I think you're looking at. In those cases, again, they didn't deal with conversion, Your Honor. The precise issue that is before this court was never addressed in the decisions of those courts. Apparently is an important term, though, Your Honor. Apparently they didn't. We don't know that, Your Honor, because it is not addressed at all substantively. They didn't require, we don't know that it was addressed at all, though, Your Honor, whereas it is precisely before this court. In this court, the precise issue of whether you need to convert has been briefed and is before the court. The fact that we're talking about it, the fact that it's in the briefs, is before this court. There is no indication on those decisions that did not convert that matter was in any way before the court. There's no discussion about it at all. There's no discussion of Ruth. There's no discussion of conversion. And there is no discussion of whether you can decide this solely on 12b-5 without conversion. That is not in those cases. Conversely, there are other decisions here in this court where they have had that discussion and they decide you cannot convert. So actually, you can argue whether in any case that has precisely dealt with the issue, whether it be here in this court or before the Supreme Court, when it's squarely addressed by the court says you must convert consistent with Ruth. And there was no case that one can point to, nor did they, where the court has done otherwise. Question, Your Honor? Okay. And therefore, I think that's very important here. Because otherwise, the decisions that you're looking at, whether it be Negron, Goldworthy, or O'Neill, have not put the issue squarely before the court, and therefore the court did not address it. Here, the issue is squarely before the court. And the only way that the decision below can be upheld here, the only way, is if this court decides to overturn Ruth and say that conversion is no longer required. And there is no authority for that. Okay? The closest you can get is federal authority in other jurisdictions, which is something that in dicta was discussed in the Peterson Electric. But that federal authority is very different, not the least of which is because in that federal authority, they do not have the fee-shifting statute that we have here in Colorado, 1317-201. Which I think dramatically changes about it. Yes, Your Honor.
That for one, basically you're saying because shifting statute is in Colorado, the other party cannot apply a procedure that would otherwise exist. This particular argument about, oh, it's a lot different because there's no fee shifting statute, would seem to me to suggest that, well, you could do it in other types of actions, you just can't do it here.
I'm sorry, I don't quite understand your argument. Other types of actions, you mean as opposed to the actions?
Other types of torts. Other than torts.
But Your Honor, I think that one has to look to what the legislature had determined. And the legislature had determined a very narrow fee-shifting statute. Okay, and that very narrow one was precisely on the early grounds of a motion to dismiss. It did not look at the idea that whether Colorado would change its system by allowing certain affirmative defenses to now be addressed at that point. And I think that that's very important. And in fact, in Peterson Electric, it's very specific to say this is only permissible when there won't be prejudice to the plaintiff. Well, the fee-shifting statute in and of itself makes for prejudice for the plaintiff. Therefore, it's an instance where you can't do this.
I think an argument can be made that basically it's not allowing the other party to take
otherwise of it.
And I would argue, Your Honor, that that is something for the legislature, as it would say respectively, to determine. And the legislature looked at this in terms of what it decided to do with 1317-201.
On to the merits.
I will, Your Honor. If we have to get to the merits, which I don't believe we necessarily have to, Your Honor, but if we have to get to the end.
Let me ask you this. You don't
want the case being dismissed as long as you don't have attorney's
fees? What? No, that's not true remotely, Your Honor. I think that we absolutely want our day in court. I think that if you were to go with the earlier procedural matter, it would have to be sent back to the trial court.
I understood your choose possibly determine matters of law, just not under 12b-5.
I think, Your Honor, that our worst case scenario here for us would be if that's what occurs, if it's only about the attorney's fees, because I do believe, Your Honor, that everyone is entitled to their day in court. And that is precisely what did not occur here. And that's how we get to the merits of this case. If you get to the merits of this case, what we're looking at is whether or not, under issue preclusion, what occurred in the California action was identical to the issue that is presented in the Colorado action before us. And I think it is absolutely clear on the facts of the matter, Your Honor, that they are not identical. Why is that? In the California action, what was before the court and what was actually determined by the jury, this is important, what was actually determined by the jury was whether the author Clive Cussler's statements, whether his statements caused harm to Bristol Bay.
Statements also Agent Lampak statements.
Actually, Your Honor, only Agent Lampak statements if they could be attributed to Clive Cussler. And the jury did not determine that. There was an issue as to whether or not he was acting within or outside the scope of his authority.
Well, let me ask you this. There was an instruction saying the statements of Mr. Lampak were attributable, if acting within his agency, to Mr. Cussler. And it appears to me, or at least from my review of the record, I have not seen a dispute in the record as to whether he was acting within the scope of his agency when he made these statements.
There's absolutely a dispute on that.
Well, where in the record is it, counsel?
Yeah, what I will do is when I come back to our record, look that up, and I'll take away from the larger argument, I will give you those specific points that we have within our record, because it is absolutely within the record that that was a matter of dispute. In fact, Clive Cussler indicated repeatedly at trial that if Mr. Lampak did that, he was not doing that at his behest. It would be outside his scope.
That's the one point. But at his knowledge, not.
I understand the distinction, Your Honor. I will look at the thing and address the same when I come back. Your Honor, the idea of issue preclusion is very, very narrow. It has to be precisely the same. Okay? It has to be something that was actually litigated, and it has to be something that was already actually litigated but necessarily decided. It is determined that this exception to your day in court has to be very narrowly determined, and therefore it must be identical. And this court has repeatedly determined that unless it's absolutely identical, you will get your day in court. There can't be issue preclusion. And here, the matter is not remotely identical. You have Clive Cussler making a statement, okay, about having 100 books that he sold. That is entirely different from publishers, the people who keep the records, the publishers who put them on every one of their covers, the ones who put them on their websites, the ones who put them in their public relations statements. It was everywhere for years and years that he had 70 million, and by the way, a different statement, that he had 70 million readers, that he had 70 million books in print, then he had 80 million, then 90 million, then 100 million, then 120 million, then 125 million. So by the time the movie was made, it was 150 books, either in print or 150 million books in print or 150 million readers. Very important to note the difference between the person who says that, a publisher who controls the information, as opposed to the puffery of an author who indicated at trial, as the record shows, that he was relying on his publishers, he was relying on his agent for the statement he made. That's why we had two distinct matters here. We had a matter in Colorado and a matter that we had to file. We had to file it against Clive Cussler when we discovered the fraud in California.
But the jury determined that his statements were false.
Because his statements were false, and they were. But they also said that it was not, and this is the important matter, a substantial factor in the harm. Clive Cussler's statements were not a substantial factor in the harm. They did not determine that the publisher's statements were not a substantial factor in the harm. And that's why the day in court must occur here. It is very common for two different statements to be viewed. And you can look at the Schutzky case does this absolutely. You can
remember that count?
Schutzky. S-H-U-T-Z-K-Y, it looks at different statements and says, yes, you can reasonably rely on both, but in ultimately what is a substantial factor in the harm caused, it can be just one statement, even though you rely on both and not the other. And that's what we believe happened here. What happened here was there was substantial reliance on the defendants here, their statements, and not on Mr. Cussler. And that's what the jury actually found. And that's why the issues are not identical. And because they're not identical, what happened here is the defendant's statements were not at issue in the California action. And therefore, they must be allowed to proceed here. I'm going to reserve the remainder of my time, if I may, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Reed Newrider, registration number 29747. I represent Simon & Schuster and will be arguing the question of issue preclusion on behalf of the appellees and then ceding 2 minutes to Mr. G, who represents Mr. Lampak.
Someone here?
I am making the argument on behalf of all the defendants with respect to issue preclusions. Mr.
I am Greg Tamkin, 27105. I am representing Penguin Hill, Mr. Newrider as well.
Okay. Bristol Bay spent more than $15 million and 52,000 hours in California litigating, among other things, whether Bristol Bay was damaged by its reliance on statements exaggerating the size of Clive Cussler's fan base, the potential audience for a film based on his books. The question for this court is whether, having failed to convince a California jury that Bristol Bay was damaged by reliance on the exaggerated size of the Cussler fan base, it should be allowed to try again in Colorado. The
Different parties.
The question for this court is whether issue preclusion prevents it. I want to talk about two things in my limited time. One is, what is the issue to be precluded? And two, what authorities you should look to for deciding whether the issue decided in California was identical to the issue decided to be decided here in Colorado for issue preclusion purposes. First, what is the issue? The issue decided in California is that Bristol Bay seeks to relitigate here is whether Bristol Bay was harmed by its reliance on false statements exaggerating the size of Clive Cussler's audience. Yes, false statements made. And I think the important distinction is, and this is what our case depends on, is the fact that there was reliance. So you look at the mechanism of how fraud works as a tort. It's not like an assault where I throw a rock and hit somebody, act or harm. It works through the mind of the listener. False statement is made. Listener hears that, relies on it, and then is harmed because of their action. The definition in the jury instructions in California for what reliance was action or inaction based on the misrepresentations. Critically, the jury, in the answer to question number 39, found reliance. No, actually, in doing what Bristol Bay says they did, and the argument was, and it's in their pleadings in California, our reliance was we signed the contract and we made the movie. That's in their complaint. That was in their argument to the jury.
Do the element instructions on these claims didn't refer to the action or Bristol Bay's action and reliance as entering into the contract?
They did, and then you also have to look at the damages instruction. Because the damages instruction, they are, but the damages instruction, if I may, said the party may also recover the amounts that it reasonably spent in reliance on the fraud or negligent misrepresentation if those amounts would not have otherwise been spent. And the argument made by Mr. Putnam in California to the jury and in their complaint was we relied by signing the contract, making the movie, and they asked for $50 million. They didn't ask for $10 million. They asked for $50 million or more, actually $85 million, the entire amount that they lost in making the film. So this notion that somehow, well, we were limited to signing the contract, that's what the jury found. The jury found reliance. Their argument was we relied by signing the contract and making the movie. The jury found no damages resulting from that reliance. So that's
no damages resulting from that reliance. It's resulting on Mr. to represent.
I think that the jury found there were that the reliance on the misrepresentations was not a substantial factor in causing the harm.
So that's the nature. Could there not be a different result then with respect to the publisher? For example, if the publisher made misstatements because it's in that business and it actually keeps those figures, could that not have been a misrepresentation that was not only relied upon but significantly affected the decision whether to go forward?
I think that in a different case that would be, I'm accepting, as I think this court should, what Bristol Bay said in its complaint in California, its complaint in Colorado, and in its argument to the jury in California, which is that the reliance was identical. And you don't have to take my word for it. Look at their complaint in Colorado. In their Colorado complaint, they equate the statements of Clive Cussler, the statements of Peter Lampack, the statements of the publishers in their
California?
No, in their complaint in Colorado. In their complaint in Colorado, in California, they equated the statements of Peter Lampack and Clive Cussler. And then in Colorado, they say they're all the same. Look at And they say in paragraph 49 of their complaint in Colorado that their reliance on the publisher's statements and on Lampak's statements were the same. I'll give you an example. In California, they talk about Peter Lampak making the same statement, 100 million books sold as Clive Cussler, and also 125 million books sold, I think, a year later. So this period of time existed in the California case. In Colorado, they point to Peter Lampak and Clive Cussler making the same statements, the exact same statements that were issued in California. Then they have an aiding and abetting claim against Mr. Lampak, saying that Mr. Lampak was assisting in Clive Cussler's fraudulent scheme to exaggerate the size of the fan base. Then there's a conspiracy claim between Lampak and Cussler, all with the same object, to exaggerate the size of the fan base. And then there's a conspiracy claim against the publishers as well, saying that the publishers conspired with Peter Lampak. What's the object of that conspiracy? To exaggerate the size of the fan base. And so, ultimately, you're going to have to decide. There are these subtle distinctions between the statements, the speakers. Does it matter for collateral estoppel purpose? I suggest to you the answer is no, it doesn't. This, according to the law, is not a bark level analysis. It's not even a tree level analysis. It's a forest level analysis. Is it identical to the point where it's unfair to the other side if we don't give them a chance to litigate this again? What are the sources for that, my saying that? One is the restatement of judgments, section 27, comment C, and the illustrations given there. That
doesn't statement subsequent act same party.
There are examples in the illustrations that talk about same parties, but I think there are also, they make it clear that it's the issue decided. So for example, and this issue of separate parties is important. Let me give you an example. Let's say everybody's at a party and a five-year-old girl comes in and says, the sky is falling, it's gonna hit the house, everybody needs to go outside. It's like, okay, five-year-old girl, maybe we don't, or boy, we don't pay so much attention. Scientist in lab coat comes in, says a satellite is falling. It really is. The sky is falling. Everybody needs to go outside. Everybody goes outside. They slip and fall on the icy glass and on the ice. And they sue. First, they sue the little girl. And the jury concludes you did rely on the little girl, even though hypothetically there's this difference between the scientist and the girl. You did rely. You went outside because she said it, but the jury found you slipped on the glass. It wasn't something else that she said that caused your harm. So the misrepresentation was not the cause of your harm. Let's assume that's the first finding. You can't sue the scientist later if your allegation is we relied on the same statement saying we should go outside because the sky is falling, even if hypothetically there's this difference in the relative a credibility of the two speakers. If the circumstances are, and your allegation is, that you relied in exactly the same way.
Talks about same parties, not little girl and scientist. They talk about little girl and the scientists are in both cases. Do you have any authority to support your proposition?
I don't have it with respect to a fraud case, but I would suggest that the court look at the case of Kret versus Kret, which we cited to the trial court, and it's a state out of New York that dealt with a medical malpractice case. And there was a claim against an attending physician where there was a bad baby, a bad outcome from a birth. And the jury concluded that the mechanism of the harm, placenta previa or whatever it is, wasn't present in the first lawsuit against the attending physician. They then sue the hospital and the resident in the second case. And the court said, you know what, it's against a different party, but the claimed harm is the same. And it was determined in the first case that the event that caused the harm is not attributable here, it didn't exist, and therefore you can't try and establish it in the second case. And that's really what they're trying to do. So if you look at the restatement of judgments, which asks these questions, balancing the interest. Do you give them a shot again, or are we going to really waste the judicial resources to have litigation on something that you already decided? You ask, is there a substantial overlap between evidence or argument to be advanced in the second proceeding and that advanced in the first? Does the new evidence or argument involve application of the same rule of law involved in the prior proceeding? Could pretrial preparation and discovery related to the matter presented in the first action reasonably be expected to have embraced the matter sought to be presented in the second? And how closely related are the claims involved in the two proceedings? If you ask those questions with respect to the reliance of Bristol Bay, look at paragraph 49 of their complaint in Colorado, where they say, we relied the same way on the representations of the publishers as we did on the representations of Peter Lampack, which they've told you in paragraph 20 are the same representations of Clive Cussler. Your answer is, this case is precluded.
The application of those four factors of comment C to the facts of this case?
We did not. We did in front of Judge Hagelin below, and that is part of the record. So I would suggest if you want to look at the application, you could look at that. The next authority that you should look to is Judge Kopelke's opinion in Huffman versus Westmoreland. There's a very important line in there that I think is instructive, where the claims are, and I quote, sufficiently intertwined within the same factual transaction and the major thrust of the claims is identical, then for issue preclusion purposes, they will be identical. And so I think that if you look at that language and apply it here, that case had to do with, I think there was a negligent misrepresentation claim, and then there was a claim under the Colorado Securities Act. And Judge Kopelke held that they were, in fact, the same claims sufficiently intertwined. And I understand.
Are you saying
they were? I believe they were different parties. I may be incorrect. I may be incorrect on that. I can't say for certain. The last authority I'd suggest you look at is a line from, it's both in Bebo and Salida School District, and this gets to the notion of what does collateral estoppel intended to do? It intends to relieve the parties of the cost and vexation of multiple lawsuits, conserve judicial resources, and by preventing inconsistent decisions, encourage reliance on adjudication. There is no way, when you compare the allegations in Colorado to the allegations in California, and I suggest you look at page 20 of our brief, where we lay out a table putting together all the elements of the claims and how they are precisely identical, there's no way that you could conclude that a verdict here in Colorado for Bristol Bay is consistent with the verdict in California that they were not harmed by misstatements exaggerating the size of their fan base. I will cede 2 minutes to Mr. G.
Stop the clock, please. Bailiff, please stop the clock. Okay, is anyone of you prepared?
I'm prepared to do it if you want me to. I think.
I would not, but.
Oh, I would like you to address it.
Give you a minute to do that, and I will give you an extra minute.
I'll give you. When you come back, we try to keep track of these minutes. So good luck. You got a minute.
Okay, I got a minute. I think the Peterson case that you cite is directly on point. In the 40 years since the Ruth case was decided, both this court and the federal courts, which the Peterson case notes, you're allowed to look to for instruction on how you interpret this.
But how can we do that if we have a binding Colorado Supreme Court decision?
Well, I think you can look to the O'Neill case where the Colorado Supreme Court, I disagree with Mr. Putnam, I think opposing counsel, that in the O'Neill case, the court implicitly assumed that this procedure of filing a motion to dismiss is appropriate when looking at the complaint and things of which you can take judicial notice. Because you ought to ask yourselves, what is it that conversion would accomplish here? The whole point of converting something that refers to material outside of the complaint is to give the opposing party an opportunity to get affidavits or other evidence to create a genuine issue of material fact. Well, that doesn't serve any purpose here because all the information is either you can take judicial notice of, or it's contained in the complaint. And I've used my minute. Thank you.
My name is Ty G, registration number 19772, and I represent the Lampack defendants. I'll say one thing about the Peterson case. It may not be necessary, as Judge Kopelke was referring to actually decide the question of whether or not conversion is required. If you look at the Peterson case, one of the things that Peterson did was it said that if the defending party has had an opportunity to litigate the issue, has not been prejudiced, and in fact did litigate the issue, there is no point in converting the issue, and 12B is a perfectly appropriate vehicle.
Except we've got those columns standing in the way.
Right, and what I was suggesting was that when you have the O'Neill case stating that or implying that this is appropriate, and when you have Peterson suggesting that there certainly is no prejudice in converting, and in fact the vehicle is exactly the same. They're all questions of law. There are no factual disputes involved. Mr. Putnam, opposing counsel, and all the litigants had an opportunity fully and fairly to litigate the issue. With regard to the merits, Your Honors, it seems to me that Bristol Bay loses as to the Lamp Act defendants either under issue preclusion or under claim preclusion or both. And with regard to issue preclusion, there isn't any question that the 100 million books sold misrepresentation was the issue in California. And Mr. Putnam, during his presentation this morning, said that Clive Cussler was found by the jury to have said 100 million books sold. If that's the case, we cannot possibly have an outside the scope defense by Clive Cussler, because he adopted whatever it was that Mr. Lampack said, the 100 million books sold representation. And with regard to claim preclusion, even if there was such a defense of outside the scope, Your Honor, the jury rejected that defense. It was not a defense personal to Mr. Cussler. If you look at question number 36 to the jury, it was, did Cussler make a false representation of an important fact to Crusader Entertainment? Answer, yes. What does the yes mean? It must mean that either A, Clive Cussler made a misrepresentation of 100 million books sold, or B, Peter Lampack, in the scope of his authority, made the 100 million books sold. And when the jury makes these findings, it is rejecting necessarily this so-called defense of outside the scope. Therefore, Section 51 applies, and claim preclusion would bar this litigation against the Lampack defendants.
Jim.
Yes.
It should be a short one. Do you agree that there was a factual dispute in the California case over whether Mr. Lampack was acting within the scope of his agency?
No, I do not.
Thank you.
We're adding on an extra minute. Thank you.
The race is on. Your Honor, here's an opening statement that was made by counsel for Clive Cussler. He goes on to say in his opening statement that, oh, I got the wrong one, goes to say in his opening statement, and I'm just going to say on CD 1833 to 1834, his opening statement, and then throughout the entire trial, he goes on to show why all of the statements made by the defendants here are not the same as the statements that were made by Clive Cussler, and that the only issue at trial in the California action are Clive Cussler's statements.
And your closing argument from the case suggests that readership, books sold, imprint, it's all the same, it's all a misrepresentation on fan base.
Because it is a representation of fan base, but that is not what was actually decided by the jury.
Did you ask them to decide that?
I asked them to decide, but if you look at what they decided, Your Honor, if you look at question 39, it's very precise. It says, did Clive Cussler's misstatements cause the harm? That is what was decided. There's nothing in that about the manufacturers here. We were not able, Your Honor, to bring the manufacturers into the suit in California. It was the eve of trial. We suddenly had a mandatory cross-claim. We had to bring it as to Mr. Cussler. And we did so in California because we had to. We filed concurrently a separate action here. Could we have brought them both here? We wish we could have, but you couldn't. It was mandatory to bring it, Clive Cussler, there was already an action. Moreover, that is a claim preclusion argument. They did, could you have brought them together? That is not an issue preclusion argument. You don't have to bring them together. I'm allowed to bring them separately. And you have cases that show that, Your Honor. We cited to Brecht. We cited to Poole. We cited to Metropolitan Gas Repair. They're all cases that show you can bring them separately. And the case I mentioned to you a moment ago, Your Honor,
separately, why?
For any reason that you choose. If they're not required to go together, you don't have to bring them together. I can decide to bring an
action. If the issue has been actually decided in the other action, you can bring it separately again.
No.
Okay. Then I think we need to come back to the issue and the issue preclusion.
What the issue is, Your Honor, the issue that was decided in California was whether Clive Cussler's misstatements caused harm.
And including statements by Mr. Lampack in his role as an agent.
I actually think, Your Honor, if you look at what the district court decided about the lack of privity, what he said rightly, if you look at what was decided, was that Clive Cussler did not indicate that Mr. Lampack was acting at his behest. He indicated, as you note from the record, Your Honor, he had indicated that I don't know what he said. I don't know what he did. I don't know what he was saying. And therefore ran away from it. And as a result, the matter was squarely put before the jury, and we don't know what the jury decided. And by not knowing, it was clear ambiguity is something that has to be found in favor of the party not seeking to have issue preclusion. And that is what occurred here, Your Honor.
Thank you. Counsel, both sets of counsel for excellent arguments in this case. The case will stand submitted. Of course.